supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Special Counsel Robert Mueller yesterday announced charges filed against three advisors to President Donald Trump's campaign related to alleged coordination with the Russian government to sabotage the 2016 election. Today, a Delaware lawmaker is urging the release of a bill aiming to keep tabs on bad actors looking to hide tainted money in LLCs. WHYY's Zoe Reed reports.
Former campaign chairman Paul Manafort pled not guilty to money laundering, tax fraud, and foreign lobbying related to work in Ukraine. The indictment states that of the 23 LLCs Manafort used in the alleged scheme, 9 were in Delaware. State Representative John Kowalko says this shows Delaware is complicit in enabling corruption through lax LLC licensing laws. His bill aims to weed out those using an LLC status to hide corrupt activities by restricting individuals and entities identified by federal agencies as a threat to the country. Introduced in January, the bill was considered in the House Judicial Committee in June, but was tabled. Vice Chair, State Representative Melanie George Smith, said she was concerned the bill had not gone through the Delaware State Bar Association's corporation law. Matthew O'Toole of the association said the bill was vaguely worded and felt the issue was best addressed at the federal level. Kowalko is now calling for the bill to be released.
This will enable us to guard against future intrusions, whether it be the realm of the case of Backpage in the realm of human trafficking, or in the case of El Chapo, who had Delaware LLC with drug running, and other instances where it has been ascertained that there are money launderers, drug money smugglers, arming of terrorist organizations that are filtering and laundering their money through Delaware LLCs. And it should not be that difficult, first of all, to identify some of these really overt threatening applicants.
The General Assembly reconvenes in January. From the Delaware desk, Zoe Reed, WHYY News.
President Donald Trump has declared the nation's opioid crisis a national health emergency. But before he focused attention on the issue, several lawmakers from the region were taking the lead on it in Congress. WHYY's Washington correspondent Matt Laszlo reports there are several bills looking to tackle the epidemic.
While the president always has his critics, he's largely garnering praise for declaring the opioid crisis a public health emergency. South Jersey Republican Tom MacArthur is one of the leaders of the bipartisan heroin task force.
We think an emergency declaration is important, in part because it frees up resources, it cuts some red tape, allows the president to do things. For example, he may be able to do the IMD, that's the number of beds available to people with the addiction. He might be able to free that up more quickly with a declaration. So we support that.
MacArthur isn't the only leader on opioids from our region. The heroin task force is also led by South Jersey Democrat Donald Norcross and Bucks County Republican Brian Fitzpatrick. The group just successfully ushered the Interdict Act through the House. As a former FBI agent, Fitzpatrick says that bill is important because it's focused on stopping fentanyl and other synthetic opioids from sneaking past Customs and Border Patrol agents.
Giving our CBP officers, our Border Patrol agents, the chemical screening equipment that they need at all points of entry to detect packages that may contain this, because a lot of the OD deaths are resulting from fentanyl-laced heroin.
The group is pushing a series of six bills that range from addiction recovery to synthetic drugs. On the day WHYY caught up with Fitzpatrick, he had a stack of cards in his pockets to hand out to his House colleagues that detailed information on an opioid-related bill. Half were for him to give his fellow Republicans, and the other half were for his Democratic partner, Congresswoman Stephanie Murphy of Florida.
I have a stack of cards for her to give out to her colleagues. I have a stack I'm going to give out to my colleagues. It has our legislative director's information, explains the bill on the front, and all the supporting organizations on the back. And the way we get things like this across the finish line is to get enough co-sponsors on board, where you build enough critical mass where it forces leadership to put it on the House floor for a full floor vote.
Nationwide, more than 59,000 people died from overdoses last year alone, which is why Fitzpatrick says lawmakers need to show compassion when dealing with the crisis.
Yeah, I mean, the real travesty, one of the many travesties with this whole epidemic, is that 9 times out of 10, it's starting in people's medicine cabinets in their homes. almost invariably, almost without exception, these cases have their genesis with prescription medication.
In neighboring Delaware, it's a different problem altogether. The state's Democratic Congresswoman, Lisa Blunt Rochester, says it's important for officials in the region to coordinate across state lines.
One of the big issues for us is that Delaware is so small, it's hard for us to think of trying to tackle something like this on our own. So we've partnered with New Jersey and Pennsylvania, myself and the other Congress members, to even write a letter to say we need the support to be able to share information with our doctors if they're giving out prescriptions, so that people who might jump from state to state, because we're in such close proximity, don't take advantage of, you know, that close proximity.
Blunt Rochester has introduced a bill called the CRIB Act, which is focused on the sad reality of babies being born addicted to opioids.
And that is really the focus of it, is to look at those babies that may be born addicted, and how do we address that as well. But I think, again, it's a community-wide issue. It's a family-wide issue, and it's a public health issue. And I think that's probably one of the biggest takeaways that we want people to realize, is that this impacts our economy as well.
As for South Jersey's Norcross, the other Democratic leader of the heroin task force, he's pushing a bill demanding medical schools spend more time training future doctors on opioid abuse.
4 hours of education and 4 years of medical school is clearly not enough. And also about continuing education, something that historically the medical schools did on their own. But with 65,000 people dying each year, there's a problem that's not being addressed. So we're going to work with them to address that issue.
Still, Norcross says the medical community doesn't carry all the blame for overprescribing.
We, as a whole, are all involved in this. It's not about assessing blame here. It's about how do we deal with this medical condition so that our young men and women, old men and women, children aren't dying.
While the president is using his bully pulpit to put the opioid crisis in the national spotlight, his emergency declaration doesn't come with much in the way of additional funding. And with 170 people dying each day from an overdose, many lawmakers from our region say the fight will require billions of dollars in new funding. Still, there's no consensus yet on what to cut to make that possible. For WHYY News, Matt Laszlo in Washington.
A Puerto Rican scientist and Rutgers grad is looking to relocate her lab and work to the East Coast in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. She says the devastation left by last month's powerful storm makes it impossible to continue her work on the island. WHYY's Mike and Scott caught up with the researcher while she was visiting Philadelphia.
Belinda Pastrana is a chemistry professor at the University of Puerto Rico at Mayagüez, and she's been there for 20 years. The Rutgers grad researches proteins that are used in medications for illnesses like Parkinson's or cancer. She also owns a startup company. When she was finally able to check on her two labs in the days after the storm, she found devastation. The substances she uses in her experiments were ruined.
So we lost all reagents that had to be refrigerated or frozen, $250,000 worth, that were very unique because they were designed and built and made in our lab.
All of the backup systems to preserve power had failed. Pastrana says she is now forced to start over in many ways, and she's relocating her lab to the mainland because she needs a reliable power supply to do her work. It's been a very emotional decision for her.
You have to keep focused on what is the bigger picture. And what we are developing can help patients around the world several times.
Pastrana says Puerto Rico will need massive help from both the government and private companies in rebuilding its power grid.
We need electricity. We need that infrastructure. You cannot imagine how important it is in terms of macroeconomics, in terms of microeconomics, in terms of keeping people alive.
Pastrana is checking out several potential locations for her company, and she's also trying to relocate some of her students to universities on the U.S. mainland. Mike and Scott, WHYY News.
Tomorrow, a task force assembled by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court will begin hearing testimony on the role of investigating grand juries. As commentator Peter Vira explains, the scrutiny is long overdue.
I am a former career federal prosecutor and former United States attorney. And I am shocked at some of the procedures I have observed in state grand juries. Unlike the federal grand jury, supervising judges of Pennsylvania state grand juries are not consistently trained, and there is no uniformity of positions taken by Commonwealth prosecutors. Witnesses and attorneys representing them are often in the dark as to what to expect when appearing in grand juries in different parts of Pennsylvania. One particular function of the present grand jury is most troublesome. The grand jury has the power to issue critical public reports about persons it does not recommend charging with a crime. These reports usually criticize a political or other public figure for conduct that violates some moral or ethical standard, but not criminal conduct. These reports are public, and they carry the weight of a grand jury vote and invite condemnation. Often the reports are simply criticism of a public figure who's a political enemy of the prosecutor or others in power. Here's one example. I once represented a township supervisor who was blasted by a report of a grand jury for investigating his own police force for fixing tickets. The grand jury, under the control of the district attorney, accused him of manipulating the police force to promote his own candidates. This amounted to a purely private employee personnel matter and should not have been the subject of an official grand jury report. The grand jury is not a social commentator. The function of a grand jury should only be to determine if there's probable cause to believe a crime has been committed. But help might be on the way. Recently, the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania created a grand jury task force chaired by a common pleas court judge and comprised of experienced criminal lawyers, several of whom are former prosecutors. I am privileged to appear before this group. But the action of the Supreme Court is only a part of the needed reform. The Pennsylvania grand jury is created by statute, and many major changes can only be accomplished by the legislature. Over a year ago, the Pennsylvania Senate Judiciary Committee undertook a study of the state grand jury statute, but nothing has occurred and no hearings have been held. Without these needed reforms, the grand jury will continue to confound lawyers and witnesses alike. Change can't come soon enough. For WHYY, I'm Peter Vira.
Commentator Peter Vira is an attorney at Greenblatt, Pierce, Funt, Fioris, LLC in Philadelphia, and a former federal prosecutor. Think of images from the American Revolution, and you probably see fields strewn with corpses. Ever wonder what happens to those bodies after the battle is over? Well, the answer can be pretty unsavory, as I learned from historian Robert Selig. He was in Philadelphia today to deliver his talk entitled "Of Skulls, Severed Heads, and Skeletons" at the Museum of the American Revolution. Now note, this conversation deals with dead bodies and may not be suitable for everyone. I started by asking about one of the more gruesome practices Selig notes, harvesting and using parts of skeletons.
Skulls and parts of skeletons were reused. There are accounts of knife handles being made out of shin bones, for example. There's another account of a man digging on a battlefield up at Fort Ann, finding a skull. And when he picked it up, it was rattling because a musket ball had gone in between the eyes and had been flattened because it is lead. And so he shook it, rattled it, took it to Peale's Museum in New York City as a curiosity. And he writes in his memoirs that he got a free ticket to see the museum content for that.
Sometimes that hole in the ground wasn't dug very deeply, and those bodies would at least in part resurface with a good storm.
Yes, it would. If it's winter and the ground is frozen, it is much harder to dig a grave. In the summer, it would be easier to dig a grave. However, there are other influencing factors that come into play then, such as the closeness of the enemy. For example, if you do not have time to bury a friend or foe in a decent grave, you just put them in the ground, and because you need to get away. The result of this, of course, is then that wolves, foxes, and other carnivores would be attracted by the smell of the blood and dig them out.
Interestingly, in addition to vultures and wolves, humans were at times interested in recovering the remains. Interestingly, those being medical school students and understandably the loved ones of those they lost.
Yeah. What comes to mind is the case of Anthony Wayne, a local hero who is buried out at Fallen Timbers where he gets killed, and his sons go out there in 1815, I want to say, and dig up the body, and the body's only partly composed. So what they do is they take the boots off because they're still usable. They put the body, what's left of it, in a kettle, boil off the flesh, and put the bones in a bag and bring it back to Philadelphia for reburial. That's also a macabre incident, I would think. You're boiling your dead ready for burial. And then another incident or another aspect that you mentioned in this context is med schools. In the early 19th century, as medical schools expand, they need bodies, they need samples. And grave robbing is actually quite an issue in the early 19th century. And once you go to battlefields, there are no relatives anywhere nearby who would know where their family is buried. So they're kind of open for plundering, really. There are also incidents where the students sell these bones to finance their medical studies without apparently much opposition or questions as to where these bones came from.
On this Halloween, let's end by bringing it full circle, noting that we are discussing the lives of those who gave in service to their cause.
Yes, I think interesting as this topic may be and necessary, I think, to talk about it, we're still talking about human beings who had parents, brothers, and sisters who were here either fighting for or against independence, who were treated at the time maybe in a way that we would consider improper or cruel or heartless, but that doesn't mean that we have to do the same thing now.
As a historian, I so appreciate you shedding light on this aspect of this war that is perhaps less understood. Thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Historian Robert Selig. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, Newsworks Tonight.